birth to Anya. Come in, Anya.
Sorry, I was thinking.
Yeah, I could see the smoke coming out of your ears. You want to tell me what's so engrossing?
I know how we can get the fix we need on a general search area. If we can somehow get access to Hartwell's service records, we could probably track down more information about the mission to recover his remains, which in turn would get us a starting point for our own search.
So what you're saying is that you need a source inside the National Military Records Center to help you get Hartwell's records, which tends to be frowned upon since it's a wee bit illegal. Never mind a federal crime.
Yep, that about sums it up. Know anyone who would commit a felony for you?
As a matter of fact, I do. Hand me your cell phone. Guess what I've got?
Half an hour later, Paul had retrieved Lieutenant Nathan Hartwell's military service records from the hotel's business fax machine.
Wow!
You forget that I'm a senior correspondent for one of the biggest magazines in the world. Our network, the people we know, are our biggest assets. We couldn't do our jobs without them.
And who might you know at the National Archives?
Sorry, journalist never reveals a source.
Anya's curiosity was still poking at her, but she let it go. The fact that they had the records was more important than who they had gotten them from, wasn't it? Of course it was.
I don't care if it came from a woman, or that Paul probably had to call her at home to get the information, given it was well after hours.
They began going through the file in detail, looking for information on Hartwell's death and the recovery of his remains. Fortunately, they found what they needed. While the file only listed Salzburg as the location where Hartwell had been killed in action, it did note the name of the recovery mission and its commanding officer. That was all they needed. From there, it was just a question of making a series of phone calls to the record keepers at the National Archives and having one of them dig up the information they were looking for. It was evening now, and those inquiries would have to wait until the next day when offices were open. Even though they'd made good headway, Anya couldn't help but feel the minutes wasting away, each one bringing them that much closer to the deadline. The next morning, Anya, with the help of an archivist, was able to track down the file number of the recovery mission that had retrieved Lieutenant Hartwell's remains. Since information on that type of operation had been declassified decades ago, she was able to submit a request for information about the mission and sweet-talked the archivist into filling it right away. A few hours later, an email arrived in her inbox containing the scanned file, which Anya read immediately.
Ha! I've got the longitude and latitude of where Hartwell's plane was recovered! We're in business!
Okay, let me get a good topographical map for it. And given the damage to the Junkers we know about, it couldn't have flown more than 10 or 20 miles further, right?
Agreed.
So, with a 20-mile radius, we're looking at this search area.
Anya stared at the circled area on Paul's computer screen with a mixture of excitement and dismay. The thrill of the hunt had caught up with her overnight, and she was feeling exactly as she usually did at the start of a new dig. Archaeology was her one true love, the thing that she came back to again and again. She relished that feeling it gave her of reaching back into the past, and the sense of satisfaction she got when she located something previously thought to have been lost forever in the mists of time. She felt that way on her first dig at Hadrian's Wall years ago, and she still felt that way today. Finding an aircraft that had been missing since World War II was the type of challenge she normally would jump at. Although the life of one of her friends didn't normally hang in the balance, completely dependent upon her success, and that's where the dismay came in. The deadline was the problem. Given enough time and materials, Anya knew that she could probably find the airplane. She didn't have any doubt about it. If it was there, she would find it. But with only 7 days to do it, actually six now, it was going to be nothing less than a Herculean task. They needed help. It was as simple as that. Good thing she knew where she could get some. Normally, she'd be worried about the price tag that would come with that help, and she would carefully consider the pros and cons of picking up the phone and getting him involved. But she didn't have the luxury to worry about such things at this point. Time was too precious a resource to waste. Whatever the price, she was willing to pay it in order to rescue Doug.
I've got to be honest, Anya. I don't know how we could search an area of that size, even with an army at our disposal. An army that, I should point out, we don't have.
Yeah, I know. I'm working on it.
With only a trace of reluctance, Anya picked up the phone and called Garin Braden.
Hello, Anya. Do what do I owe this pleasant surprise?
I hate to say it, Garin, but I need your help.
The mighty Miss Creed needs my help. You must be joking.
I'm serious, Garin. I truly need your help.
Well, in that case, let me drop everything I'm doing and rush to your aid.
Please, Garin. A friend's life is at stake, and time is of the essence.
Garin Brayden was over 500 years old. When she thought about it, that sounded crazy even to her, but she couldn't deny the fact that it was true. Garin had been squire to a French knight named Roux, who in turn had been assigned to watch over Joan of Arc. Roux and his squire had failed in their mission, and when Joan's sword was broken in the moments before her execution, the lives of the two men had been mysteriously lengthened. Over the next few centuries, Roux searched for the fragments of the blade, intending to bring them back together, while Garin fought to keep that from happening, convinced the fragmentation of the blade was the very thing that assured his extended lifespan. Anya was aware Garin had since come to realize that his efforts had likely been wasted, as her custodianship of the blade so far had had no ill effect on him. In fact, he seemed to be growing quite fond of her. Anya had diligently resisted his efforts to flirt, despite her attraction to him. The fact that he was the perfect example of tall, dark, and handsome, never mind ridiculously rich, constantly battled with her understanding that Garin cared first and foremost about himself. He was determined, ruthless, and used to getting what he wanted, no matter what the effort or cost. It made him dangerous in more ways than one. She knew it was in her best interest to stay as far away from him as she could, and yet here she was reaching out to him for help in her moment of need.
Apparently, my heart and my head aren't seeing eye to eye again.
Knowing his nature, Anya expected Garin to ask what was in it for him, and frankly, she didn't have an answer. To her great surprise, he didn't do anything of the sort.
What do you need?
There's a certain object I need to locate within a specified time frame. I can't say more over an open line.
Where are you now?
The Hotel Planeta in Negril, Jamaica.
Okay, stay there. I'll send a chopper for you.
Garin hung up before she could thank him. He always did like having the last word. Just under 3 hours later, a massive AW101 VVIP Augusta Westland helicopter settled onto the hotel lawn, inviting stares for more than a few observers. Anya didn't blame them. This was the same helicopter used to transport the President of the United States under the designation Marine One, and just seeing it up close was pretty awe-inspiring. Given that it was one of Garin's helicopters, Anya had no doubt that the interior would be even more lavish than she could imagine. She and Paul watched as the door opened and a set of steps unfolded from inside the aircraft. Seconds later, a black man with a shaved head and a soul patch on his chin appeared in the doorway. He was wearing a sharply cut suit and dark sunglasses. He scanned the small crowd assembled on the other side of the lawn before his gaze settled on Anya and her companion. He gestured them forward without hesitation. Anya crossed the lawn and climbed the stairs.
Hello, Griggs!
Matthew Griggs, head of Dragon Tech Security and Garin Braden's right-hand man, nodded to her.
Miss Creed, please make yourself comfortable.
The interior of the helicopter resembled that of a private jet more than any helicopter Anya had ever been in, with mahogany fittings, lush leather seats, and even thick carpet underfoot to help absorb the sound of the rotor blades. Griggs turned just as Paul came up the steps. The Dragon Tech security man interposed himself between Paul and the interior of the aircraft.
I'm sorry, sir, but this is a private flight.
It's all right, Griggs. He's with me.
Griggs spoke over his shoulder to Anya without taking his eyes off Paul.
Is Mr. Brayden aware of this?
He wasn't, but Anya wasn't about to admit that to Griggs.
Of course.
Very well. Please settle in and help yourself to the refreshments. We'll be in Miami in about 3 hours.
With that, he pulled up the stairs, secured the door, and returned to the cockpit. 5 minutes later, they were airborne. Glancing around the cabin, Paul was impressed.
You said you were going to get us some help, but this is a bit more than I expected. Dare I ask who it belongs to?
Garin Brayden.
Garin Brayden?
Yes.
Garin Brayden, the industrialist?
Among other things, yes. Why, is something wrong?
Brayden and I had a bit of a run-in at a press conference when I asked him some uncomfortable questions.
When was this?
A year, maybe 18 months ago. I'm sure he's forgotten about it by now.
Anya wasn't so sure of that. Garin tended to carry a grudge longer than anyone she knew, but she agreed and left it alone for the time being. If it was an issue, they'd deal with it later.
We might as well relax. We've got a few hours of flight time ahead of us, it seems.
I'm gonna check out the cabin more thoroughly.
While Paul wandered around, Anya pulled her laptop out of her backpack and fired it up. She connected the flight's onboard Wi-Fi and began researching the Junkers aircraft and its capabilities. Getting a better sense of its strengths and weaknesses would allow her to better pinpoint how far it might have gone after being damaged in the dogfight with Captain Mitchell and his wingman, which in turn might allow them to narrow their search area. Fortunately, there was a fair bit of information available.
The Junkers U-88 was a twin-engine, multi-role combat aircraft built by the German firm Junkers Flugzeuge und Motorenwerke for use by the Luftwaffe in World War II.
It had been intended to be a fast bomber that could outrun any Allied fighters that tried to chase it. According to most of the sources Anya checked, it had been moderately successful. Despite being plagued by several problems in the later part of its development, the aircraft and its many variants were in constant production from 1939 to the end of the war in 1945. More than 160,000 were built, more than any other German twin-engine aircraft of the time period. It served successfully as a bomber, dive bomber, night fighter, heavy fighter, and reconnaissance aircraft. They had seen heavy action during the Battle of Norway, the Battle of France, and the Battle of Britain, as well as in various campaigns on the Eastern Front.
Junkers had a top speed of 292 miles per hour, a ceiling of 29,000 feet, and a maximum range of 1,700 miles.
It had been built to be flown by a crew of either three or four, though one man could manage it on his own if the rear-facing cockpit guns and the weapons bay under the nose were left unmanned. Anya's research told her that one of the key features of the Junkers aircraft was its ability to keep fighting even after taking heavy damage. That explained how the target aircraft had managed to stay aloft despite being savaged by the pair of P-51s under Mitchell's command. That concerned her somewhat, as the Junkers' hardiness might mean it had managed to go even farther than they suspected after the destruction of the Mustangs. All in all, it seemed like a pretty hardy aircraft. It made her wonder what the pilot's destination had been.
So where had he been trying to go with all that gold?
She called up a map of Europe and the Middle East on her screen. She looked at it for several minutes, trying to work out reasonable routes in her head. With a possible range of 1,700 miles, the pilot certainly had his choice of destinations available to him. If he'd flown due south, he could have reached the deep deserts beyond Tripoli in Libya. Flying due west would have taken him nearly to Atyrau, Kazakhstan. An agent of the Reich might have found assistance in either location and could have flown on from there after refueling. While dangerous, both would have been safer than the route he had chosen, southeast through Austria and into the teeth of the Allied army marching north toward Berlin. It didn't make a lot of sense.
But nothing made a lot of sense in those days. The war was all but lost and the Reich was falling apart. The guy probably loaded up what he could and made a run for it. Stop trying to read more into it or you'll drive yourself nuts.
With that warning ringing in her ears, she put the laptop away and sat back to enjoy the rest of the flight. She knew all too well that there would be far too little time for rest in the days ahead. Griggs' estimate had been right on the money. They landed at Miami International Airport just under 3 hours later. A black SUV with dark tinted windows was waiting for them next to the helipad. Anya assumed they would be taken to wherever Garin was staying, so she was surprised when the driver raced around several parked Airbuses and delivered them to a sleek business jet waiting for them on the other side of the terminal. Anya was about to ask what was going on when she noticed the corporate logo of a gold dragon poised in mid-flight on the tail of the aircraft. It was the same one that had been on the tail rotor of the helicopter they'd just left behind, Dragon Tech Security.
Mr. Braden is waiting for you on board.
Griggs escorted them up the steps and into the aircraft. Garin Braden stood as they entered the aircraft.
Ah, Anya. So good to see you.
Garin was a big man, both physically and charismatically. He seemed to fill the room wherever he was. His dark hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and his beard was immaculately groomed as usual. This day he was dressed in a dark shirt and jeans, which was unusual for him. Anya was more used to seeing him in impeccably cut suits.
And this, who is your friend?
Paul Krugman. And Paul, this is Garin Brayden.
Paul Krugman.
Garin seemed to hold the other man's hand just a moment longer than normal. Had he recognized Paul? Garin didn't say anything or acknowledge that the two had previously met, so Anya let it go.
Please, sit.
He ushered them into chairs opposite his own and got right down to business.
You said it was urgent. Tell me what's going on.
Anya laid it all out for him. Doug's kidnapping, the phone call, the package, the fact that the kidnapper knew she was in Jamaica, the demand that she find and recover the plane and its contents. The only thing she left out was the fact that she was romantically involved with Paul. She didn't need Garin critiquing her choice of companions, but she knew he would do so anyway. No sense in giving him more ammunition for the task. When she was finished, Garin sat back and considered what she had said.
Who knew that you were going to be in Jamaica?
Me or Paul?
The two of you together?
No more than a handful of people.
Who, specifically?
The editor who assigned me the story I was supposed to cover, and his assistant, I'd guess. The secretary who booked my flights and hotel reservations. That's about it.
Did they know Anya was going with you?
No.
What about you, Anya? Who knew that you were going to Jamaica with Paul?
No one, really. He asked me to go last minute, and I just packed up and went.
You didn't tell any of your friends, people you hang out with?
I didn't tell anyone.
Doug didn't know where you were going?
I don't think so. I told him that I was going to take a week's vacation, but I didn't tell him where.
How about his secretary?
No, definitely not. Why? What's this about?
I'm just trying to figure out how the kidnapper knew that you were in Jamaica. If you and Paul are the only two who knew you were going to be there, I have to wonder if he's the man behind all this.
Anya was so stunned by the suggestion that she didn't know what to say.
You can't be serious.
Seems pretty suspicious to me. He invited you to Jamaica. He booked the hotel. He knew what room you were in, and even when you were there and when you weren't. He could easily have dropped off the package at the front desk with no one the wiser.
Now, wait just a minute.
Paul was with me the whole time we were in Jamaica. It's not like he could have flown back to the mainland and kidnapped Doug when I wasn't looking.
Aren't you the one who said Doug had been missing for a few days before you spoke to his assistant? For all you know, he could easily have kidnapped Doug and left him somewhere long before he met you for the flight to the Caribbean.
The frown that had blossomed on Anya's face at Garin's initial suggestion now deepened.
This isn't funny, Garin.
I'm not trying to be funny. Tell me something. Was Paul in the room with you when the kidnapper called?
No, I was alone.
So how do you know it wasn't him?
Knock it off. Right now, I don't have time for this kind of joke. Paul isn't the kidnapper, and that's final. I fully vouch for him.
All right, if you say so. My apologies, Paul.
It was the smile that did it. Garin had intentionally ruffled Paul's feathers, no doubt in payback for Paul's rudeness during the interview when they'd first met.
The guy can sure hold a grudge.
So what is it that you want from me?
I don't have the resources I need to conduct the search. I was hoping you could supply equipment and manpower.
Uh-huh. What's in it for me?
Nothing, except my thanks.
Let me get this straight. You want me to spend millions of dollars to finance a massive search for a plane that's been missing for 70 years and might not even be in the location we're searching, never mind my time and attention, for nothing but a word of thanks from you.
Garin, look, Doug's life is—
Just answer the question. Yes or no? Is that what you expect?
Paul bristled, and Anya thought he was going to step in, so she glared at him to keep him quiet.
Yes, that's exactly what I expect.
She thought he'd argue, or bargain, or at the very least laugh at the idea. As long as she'd known him, Garin had done what was best for Garin. Expecting him to change now would be like asking water not to be wet.
Sure, I'll help you. I am at your service in every way.
Given the fox in the henhouse look on his face, Anya knew she'd said or done something that was going to come back and bite her on the butt at some point, but she'd worry about that later. First, there was a 10-hour flight from Miami to Munich, Germany, during which Anya caught up on her sleep, and Garin made numerous preparations via phone. In Munich, they boarded a Spartan helicopter, which was outfitted with duffel bags for Anya and Paul, filled with appropriately sized boots, gloves, and coats. Then it was off to the Austrian border and the Alps. Anya thought they would fly into Salzburg and then take ground transportation from there, so she was surprised when the pilot delivered them to a mountain camp on the German side of the Alps. Thanks to all of the time that she'd spent staring at the topographical map of the search area, Anya knew that they were close to the spot where Captain Mitchell's plane had crashed. A semi-permanent structure, the kind used for expedition work in out-of-the-way places, stood on a plateau at the edge of a valley. Two snowcats were parked in front of it.
Your people, I hope?
Yes, including one very special individual. You're going to like what he has to show you.
The helicopter set down a few dozen yards from the structure. Anya and her companions disembarked, with Garin leading the way through the knee-deep snow and over to the structure. Inside, they found a high-tech command center, complete with oversized monitor screens mounted along one wall, and three men seated at control stations in front of them. A fourth stood behind them, quietly giving instructions. He turned when he heard them enter and walked over to greet Garin.
Anya, meet Reinhold Drainer, CEO and founder of Geodent Industries.
Pleased to meet you.
Good to meet you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Paul Krugman, my pleasure.
The man was a short, stocky individual with black wireframe glasses, thinning hair, and what Anya would soon discover to be an infectious enthusiasm for his work.
Tell me, what's Geodent Industries?
The answer to your prayers.
I wouldn't go that far, but I do think we can help. Geodent, short for geo-identification, is a geophysical survey company. We use a set of sophisticated and proprietary tools to help find the location of subsurface deposits of various minerals, metals, and other natural resources.
So you can search for specific types of metals, even through solid rock? How do you manage that?
Reinhold stepped over to the command console and pointed at the screen mounted above it. The image on the screen was a wash of different colors, laid over what seemed to be a topographical map.
Subsurface deposits generate very distinct fields of electromagnetic radiation. By using drones capable of recording multispectral imaging and other key variables, we can measure the strength and intensity of those fields up to a depth of 5,000 meters. Which in turn helps us identify pockets of everything from oil and natural gas to precious metals.
What about non-precious metals like iron or steel? Can it pick those up too?
Ha ha, absolutely.
Anya couldn't believe what she was hearing. Using this technology would make the search for the aircraft so much easier, provided they could get the drone to operate properly in the high winds of the Alps. She turned to find Garin watching her.
You're a genius! I could almost kiss you!
Garin spread his arms out.
Please do.
I said almost.
Garin waved his hand in a gesture that was meant to take in the whole command center.
When you told me about the project, I immediately thought of Reinhold. His technology is absolutely cutting edge, so new that we haven't even announced it publicly yet. I figured this would be an excellent test run for him and his team.
And we're looking forward to the task. I was just going to check on the preparations for the drone's flight. Care to join me?
Of course.
Anya, Paul, and Garin followed the German scientist as he went through the door at the far end of the command room and entered another large room just beyond where another team of men were currently prepping the drone for flight. The aerial vehicle looked very much like the well-publicized Predator drones used by the U.S. Air Force and the CIA, but was probably a quarter of its size. Looking at it, Anya guessed it was roughly 10 feet in length, with a wingspan of something in the neighborhood of 15 feet. It had the same bulbous nose as the Predator. In fact, Anya thought that this one might be even more pronounced. It was still big, but not the monstrosity that were the Predator and its ilk. One crew member had the nose open and was making adjustments to something. The imaging equipment was Anya's guess, while a second was fueling the bird from a long hose attached to a tank in the far corner.
Once we launch the drone, we'll direct it to make systematic passes over the target area, mapping it in a grid-like fashion, similar to how you would handle a dig site, Anya. A few hours after that, the computer will be finished crunching the data and will give us a three-dimensional model of the search area complete with its findings. If the aircraft is there, I'm confident we will find it.
Fantastic.
It is, isn't it? So, let's return to the control room and determine our target area.
They returned to the control room, where Reinhold spent some time in conference with Anya, trying to identify the best section of the search area to start with. In the end, they chose an area a few kilometers wide by 10 kilometers long, moving southeast in a straight line from their current location. It matched the direction Captain Mitchell had reported last seeing the Junkers traveling, and it abutted a series of peaks that were, in Anya's view, too high for the damaged aircraft to have navigated over. They also identified two additional portions of the search area to try in case the first search was unsuccessful. An hour after they had arrived, they were all seated in the control room watching the monitors. The oddly insectile-looking craft raced down the makeshift runway of hard-packed snow and took off into the cold mountain air with barely a sound. It was a clear day, with little wind, for which Anya was deeply thankful. It would make the scanning much easier. Reinhold was quietly issuing commands to his team, and Anya was pleased to see that they worked like a well-oiled unit. These men knew their jobs and would perform to the best of their abilities. They sent the drone to the target altitude and got the search underway. At that point, there was nothing to do but wait.
We might have something. Come look!
At a word from Reinhold, the image from the drone's forward camera that was showing on the central screen was replaced by something much more complex.
What you're seeing here is a three-dimensional computer model we've built with the preliminary data sent back to us by the drone. We've isolated the various magnetic fields recorded by the drone's imaging equipment and assigned each of them a color. We have laid those colors over a topographical model of the Rift Valley itself.
The image in front of them was mostly gray, with a few blotches of dark red running throughout.
The gray color represents the baseline material of the mountains, mostly granite, dolomite, and shale.
He pointed to one of the veins of dark red running through it.
This dark color appears to be veins of hematite crystal, something the region is particularly known for. So far, nothing is surprising or out of the ordinary.
He nodded at the technician manning the controls, and the imaging began to slip down the screen, revealing more of the valley, just as if the drone were flying over it. Everything looked similar to what they'd already seen, until they reached the far end. At that point, a blotch of blue color appeared.
Initial measurements tell us that this anomaly is roughly 50 feet long by 70 feet wide and made mostly of a combination of iron, carbon, and manganese. In other words, steel! I would bet my professional reputation that this is your missing aircraft!
There was nothing more they could do that evening outside in darkness, so the crew retired, sleeping fitfully. Early the next morning, excitement was high as the team put on its cold weather gear and got ready to go out to the crash site. The plan was to take the Snowcats, Anya and Paul in one, Garin and Reinhold in the other, and see what condition the wreckage was in. Once they knew that, they could make more detailed plans for how to get at whatever it was they were supposed to recover from it. The Junkers JU-88 had a length of 47 feet and a wingspan of 65 feet, which was roughly the same size as the anomaly Reinhold had picked up with his scanning equipment. That suggested the plane was actually intact, a rather surprising discovery, but one Anya was excited about.
There were only two surviving Junker 88s in the world. Finding a third intact would be a pretty big deal.
Let's see what's out there then. To the Snowcats!
At first, it was slow going. The terrain was a mixture of rocky ridge lines, boulder-strewn hills, and long fields of glacial ice, complete with crevices large enough to swallow either of their vehicles whole. The Snowcats, however, were perfect for this kind of trek. The vehicle's four independent tracks moved up and down as well as side to side, allowing it to maneuver over, through, or around the various obstacles they encountered, while the high cab allowed excellent visibility. The fact that both vehicles were painted day-glow orange would allow them to keep each other in sight, even if the weather should turn nasty before they got back to camp. They had been underway for nearly half an hour when Paul broke Anya out of her reverie.
I'm impressed.
At what?
How quickly you managed to find this thing. It's been less than 3 days since you got that first phone call. You've flown halfway around the world, and yet you've still managed to find a literal needle in the haystack.
I did have a bit of help, you know.
Yes, but still, you were the driving force behind this, and that's impressive.
Of course, if I wasn't so good at finding lost cities and artifacts, Doug wouldn't be in the position he's in. But thanks for saying that.
We're getting close to the coordinates.
10 minutes later, they came up over the last ridge to find that the terrain flattened out ahead of them, becoming a long, sloping valley with clear ground directly ahead, allowing them to see a good distance forward. Anya immediately began looking around, searching for some sign of the wreckage, or better yet, the aircraft itself sticking up out of the snow.
Anything on your side?
No, nothing.
Where on earth is it?
The first Snowcat moved forward another half mile, then began to slow before gradually coming to a stop. Anya pulled up behind it and got out to see what was going on.
The GPS unit says we're less than 100 yards from the target.
Less than 100 yards? We should be seeing something then, shouldn't we?
I'm not sure. If the plane landed intact, then yes, we probably should. But if it broke apart on impact...
Then it could be scattered in bits and pieces underneath all this snow and we wouldn't know it.
Garin and Paul were to stay with the snowcats while Anya and Reinhold explored. They all pulled harnesses, ropes, a handheld GPS, and a metal detector out of the back of the snowcat. Anya and Reinhold each tugged on a harness and clipped into the ropes that Garin and Paul had prepared. If they encountered anything unexpected, like a snow-covered crevasse, the ropes would keep them from being dragged to their deaths before anyone had time to react. Anya was well used to such precautions, but it was obvious Reinhold wasn't as comfortable. He fussed with the harness and double-checked the knot that secured the rope to it half a dozen times until Anya calmed him.
My first time out, I was nervous too. But I've done this a lot now, and I'll be right next to you.
Is it that obvious? Thank you.
The GPS had already been programmed with the location of the anomaly from the scanned data. When they were ready, Reinhold activated the device, and the two of them stepped forward. They followed the signal for nearly the length of a football field. Reinhold stopped.
Right here.
Anya stepped up next to him and looked around. There was nothing to see but a flat stretch of snow in every direction.
You're sure this is the right spot?
Absolutely. According to the scan, the anomaly should be right here.
So where was it? Anya turned in a slow circle, looking for something, anything, that might indicate a plane had crashed there 50 years before. Nothing caught her eye. She activated the metal detector and made a slow circuit around the spot where Reinhold was standing. When that didn't give her any hits, she moved outward about a yard and repeated the process. She kept doing that until she had made half a dozen revolutions around Reinhold. The metal detector remained frustratingly silent.
Anything?
Nothing.
Could the data have been wrong? Could the drone have picked up on something else entirely? Something not related to their search? She stopped and turned in a slow circle, looking for she didn't know what. She had the nagging feeling that she was missing something, something obvious. But for the life of her, she couldn't figure it out. She took in the flat stretch of land she was standing on, let her gaze roam to the sloping hills that rose from that flat surface on all sides.
Looks like a soup bowl?
A sudden suspicion rushed over her. She went down on one knee and began brushing aside the snow at her feet, digging with her gloved hand.
You find something?
Anya could hear Reinhold calling her, but it seemed to be coming from a long way off because her attention was focused almost entirely on what she was doing. She'd gone down about a foot when her hand struck something hard. She began clearing away more of the snow as Reinhold hurried over to help her. In just a few moments, the two of them managed to clear away a circular area about 3 feet in diameter, exposing a thick sheet of ice that ran in every direction. Anya stared down at it, her heart beating madly in her chest as she realized why they hadn't found anything.
It's not the ground. We're standing on a frozen lake.
In her mind's eye, she could picture the Junkers as it came through the pass behind them, fighting to stay aloft, with at least one, maybe two engines on fire and the wind whistling through the gaping holes in the fuselage from the Mustang's guns. It had been April, which meant the lake could just as easily have been frozen as not. But either way, the pilot had probably seen it as the best place to try to make a controlled landing. Given the size and shape of the anomaly seen on the data collected by the drone, Anya thought the pilot had pulled it off and brought the plane down relatively intact. Once he had, the plane had either broken through the ice or simply sunk to the bottom under its own weight once it filled with water.
The Junker is right here at the bottom of this lake.
Wow!
Now they just had to figure out how to get down there to prove her theory. They headed back to the heated comfort of the control room for a working lunch, and the group decided that the simplest course of action was to bring in some cold water diving gear and send someone down to verify that the aircraft was where they expected it to be. It was going to take time to assemble the gear and have it flown to the site, which troubled Anya, but the truth of the matter was that there wasn't any way around it. They needed the gear if they were going to survive going into that freezing water for even a few minutes. Without it, they would freeze to death in moments. Garin took care of the necessary arrangements, including footing the bill for all the gear. A short time later, Anya and Paul returned to the lake and used the plows on the fronts of the snowcats to clear a 15 by 15 foot area over the spot where the plane was supposed to be. Using a heating coil taken from the command center's emergency supplies and the power from one of the snowcat batteries, they managed to melt a hole 2.5 feet in diameter most of the way through the ice. At that point, they reverted to using hand axes to chop the rest of it away until they broke through. Anya stared at the dark water at the bottom of the hole, knowing that in a few short hours she would be going into its depths, and felt none of the excitement she usually felt when on the verge of a discovery of this magnitude. The sense of accomplishment, of a job well done, was completely absent. Doug's kidnapping had tainted the whole operation for her.
Stay focused. It will be over soon enough.
An hour later, the sound of rotors alerted Anya and her companions that the equipment they were waiting for had arrived. Anya watched a large helicopter marked with the Dragon Tech logo touch down long enough for the men inside to unload several large crates of equipment from the rear cargo hold. It then lifted off again to make room for another aircraft, and another. Within an hour, the quiet little camp had been transformed by a flurry of activity. Not only had Garin's men brought the necessary dive equipment, but they'd also brought generators, floodlights, and a pair of prefab cold weather shelters, one to serve as a base of operations for the dive itself, and the other for the team to sleep in. The crew got to work assembling the gear, setting up the lights, and erecting the shelter next to the hole Anya and Paul had dug through the ice. Before long, the surface of the lake was brightly lit, and they were ready to proceed. It was time to get back to the search. Paul, Garin, Anya, and Reinhold gathered inside the shelter.
Are you sure you're up for this? We've been going all day. Shouldn't we do this after a decent night's rest?
No. We've wasted enough time as it is. We need to find that plane.
Paul moved in closer and took hold of her arm.
Anya, listen to me. You need to be at your absolute best to dive in water this cold. Wait, and do it in the morning.
Anya pulled away, seriously annoyed with him for the first time.
I'm perfectly fine, Paul. I can handle this. If you don't want to be here, you can wait in the tent. But I'm going down to that wreck, and I'm doing it now.
All right, we'll do it your way. Heaven forbid I try to talk some sense into you.
Anya knew that Paul's feelings were hurt, but she didn't have time for that right now. She put it aside and concentrated on what was in front of her. Paul was right about one thing. This was a dangerous dive. The cold was her biggest enemy, but the wreck itself would be hazardous too. Add to that the fact that she would be diving alone, since neither Paul nor Garin had cold water diving experience, and the risk rose exponentially. She would need to keep her wits about her and be sure that she didn't linger too long down at the wreck. Garin and Reinhold went out to check on the setup of the guide wire she would be using for the dive, so Anya took advantage of the opportunity to strip down to her undergarments and begin pulling on her gear. She started with a polypropylene sheath that fit her like a glove and that was designed to wick away her body moisture while retaining her body heat. Over that, she pulled on a layer of insulation made of Thinsulate, a microfiber known to have a high resistance to water and one that would retain its insulating properties even when wet. Her third and final piece of undergarment protection was a shell consisting of a one-piece jumpsuit. Then, and only then, was she ready for her dry suit, which Paul helped her put on.
Okay, neck seals and hood are good. Now booties and the three-fingered mitts.
Fins came next, followed by a weight belt to help her counter the natural buoyancy of everything she was wearing. Properly suited up at last, she slipped her arms through her tank straps and hefted the oxygen tank onto her back, securing it in place. Satisfied with the fit, she tested her regulator, ensuring that it was working properly, then grabbed her mask and started for the door. The halogen floods pushed back the darkness and lit the place with their stark white light. Under their glow, the water inside the dive hole looked even darker than before. And at the sight of it, Anya felt a brush of trepidation. She shook it off and walked over to the hole, where Garin and Reinhold were waiting. A safety line had been anchored in the nearby ice, and Garin helped her clip the line to her belt. She would carry it with her down to the wreck, so that she had a guide wire to follow back up when it came time for her to surface.
Here, take this dive light. It's going to be pitch black down there.
She clipped its tether to her suit, ensuring that she wouldn't lose it if she had to let go for some reason.
Okay, one final check of equipment.
Satisfied, She sat at the edge of the hole with her feet in the water. She pulled her mask on and prepared to go into the water.
You got 30 minutes, no more. After that, we're pulling you out.
Understood.
Garin had been right. It was pitch black. The thick cover of snow on the ice above, never mind the late hour, kept even the brilliant illumination cast by the halogen floodlights from reaching her. Hovering there with only the light in her hand to guide her, she felt as if she was all alone in the universe. Time's wasting, her inner voice chided, and she listened to it, turning her face downward and kicking hard with her legs. Down she went, deeper into the gloom. Her dive light cut through the murk around her for a few feet before being swallowed up again, so she kept her pace slow and steady, moving downward a few feet at a time. At that rate, it took her several minutes to descend the 120 feet to the bottom of the lake. She paused, orienting herself, and then pushed off again, cutting through the water like a seal with powerful kicks of her legs in the direction Reinhold's scan had suggested. If the data were correct, the plane shouldn't be more than 50 feet ahead of her. She was upon it suddenly, the dark shape seeming to materialize out of the gloom as if in response to her presence. Her dive light picked out the port engine first, jutting from the wing's leading edge, the propeller still intact and covered with hanging strands of algae that moved slightly in the water's current. Anya moved a few feet to her left, bringing the rest of the aircraft into view. For a moment, all she could do was hang there in the water, staring in amazement at her discovery. The plane was surprisingly intact, given that it had crashed into a lake and spent 70 years at the bottom. The cold water had limited the corrosion that the aircraft had suffered, and the damage that she could see appeared more the result of the dogfight with Captain Mitchell and his wingman, rather than a crash landing, controlled or otherwise, into the waters of the lake. The Junkers had come to rest upright on the bottom of the lake. The landing gear had either failed or broken off when the plane struck the bottom, for the gondola beneath the nose was resting on the lake bottom, canting the plane at a slight angle. The damage to the underside of the craft appeared to be quite minimal, however. It was almost as if the lake waters had risen around the aircraft, rather than the aircraft having violently crashed into the water and sunk to the bottom. Perhaps it had landed on the ice, only to have the ice break away beneath it, she thought. It was an interesting puzzle, and one Anya wished she had the time to figure out, but sadly, that wasn't the case. She continued her inspection, conscious of the ticking clock, marking not only the consumption of her air supply, but the encroaching deadline for the project overall. She kicked upward along the nose and shone her light into the aircraft's cockpit. A grinning face stared back at her from behind the glass. Anya recoiled and nearly dropped her light, her heart pounding madly in her chest. She could feel herself sucking air out of her regulator at an accelerated pace as adrenaline flooded her system, and she forced herself to calm down and breathe easier so that she wouldn't hyperventilate. When she was calmer, she approached the cockpit once more. This time, prepared for what she would see, the grinning face behind the glass didn't startle her. She could see that it was actually the skull of the pilot, held in place atop its skeleton by the flight suit and hood that it wore. The skeleton wafted gently in the water. Anya followed the edge of the cockpit back a few feet, so that she could look into the aft section. Another skeleton sat in that part of the cockpit, still strapped securely in its seat. At first, she thought it was a navigator or gunner, one of the regular crew for a craft of this size. But then she caught sight of the twin lightning bolt insignias pinned to each side of the uniform collar that stuck up beneath the ill-fitting flight suit the corpse wore, and realized that she was staring at a member of the Waffen SS.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Her research had told her that there were two ways into the aircraft, through the cockpit, where a hatch at the gunner's feet would allow access to the bomb bay in the underside of the fuselage, or through the gondola access hatch on the underside of the plane. Entering through the cockpit made her a bit uncomfortable, since it would mean disturbing the dead. She'd do it if she had to, but first, she'd try the gondola hatch. She floated over to the other side of the fuselage to see if the plane's angle allowed better access from that position.
Maybe I can find a hole in the fuselage.
She left the cockpit behind and swam the length of the plane toward the tail. A cold chill passed over her at the sight of the Balkenkreuz, the black cross used as a symbol of the various branches of the German military, still visible through the corrosion spreading across the aircraft's wings. Along with the swastika, The cross had become a symbol of the Third Reich, known the world over, and was not something that Anya looked on with any sense of fondness whatsoever. As she neared the tail, she dipped over the side of the aircraft to take a look. She was surprised to find the entire plane intact. Aside from a few bullet holes, the fuselage was still in one piece. It looked like it was going to be the cockpit after all. A glance at her dive watch told her that she'd been down there for nearly 15 minutes. It was time to move things along a bit quicker. She swam above the aircraft and returned to the cockpit. The rear half of the reinforced glass that covered the pilot and gunner was designed to slide backward, opening the section above both seats. All she had to do was look on the outside of the cockpit for the hatch release lever used by the ground crews, and she should be able to open it without too much difficulty. Placing her hands along the lower seam where the glass met the metal edge of the cockpit, she carefully slid them along until she found the narrow groove that housed the lever. Her thick diving gloves were almost too big to fit inside, but she was patient and managed to work them through the gap well enough to grasp the handle. When she was satisfied that she had a good grip on it, she turned her face away to protect it from potential debris and gave the handle a good yank. Nothing happened. She let it fall back into place and tried again. And again. The third time turned out to be the charm as the internal mechanism finally loosened enough to pop the latch securing the canopy, allowing it to open a few inches. Anya reached beneath the edge, got a good grip, then pushed it all the way back until it locked into place, providing an opening immediately above the pilot's and gunner's seats. Anya slipped into the rear section of the cockpit, head downward, being as careful as she could not to disturb the skeleton. Her feet were sticking out of the open canopy above when she reached forward to access the hatch on the floor where the gunner's feet rested, but that was the only way she could reach it. The door had a handle on it that needed to be turned 90 degrees, and she was worried it might be stuck the way the canopy lever had been. But this one worked without a hitch. Once turned, the hatch fell forward, providing her with room to slip into the narrow access space below. The short corridor, really just a gap between internal struts and the frame of the aircraft, allowed the gunner to reach the munition storage compartment in the event that something went disastrously wrong, such as having an armed bomb get hung up on the rack. The gunner could access the situation and attempt to manually release the weapon from inside the bay, removing the danger from the aircraft. The space was tiny. There was no other word for it. Anya was not a big person, but there was barely enough room for her and the added bulk of her suit and dive tank to slip along its length, her shoulders nearly touching the walls on either side as she went. Reaching the other end, she shone her light into the starboard munitions bay and gasped at what she saw. In the space where a 500-pound bomb would normally sit was a rectangular stack of gold bars at least 3 feet wide by 2 feet high. She'd guessed what she would find, but guessing it and seeing it sitting there within arm's reach were two entirely different things, especially when you were talking about a fortune in gold. She could see a few pieces of rotting wood along the base of the stack and realized that the gold had originally been inside a wooden crate that had slowly rotted away over the years. As the wood dissolved, the gold was slowly revealed until it stood there on its own, still perfectly aligned in the manner in which it had been packed. Anya rolled over and shone her light into the port bay, only to discover the same thing. Stacks of gold bars, patiently waiting to be discovered by some lucky soul. The stack in the port bay was closer to the access tunnel, and Anya was able to reach out and pluck one of the bars from the top of the stack. It was heavy, which somehow made it seem more real to her. When she brought it closer, she could see that there was an image of a crown atop a shield etched into the surface of the gold brick. She wasn't positive, but she thought it might be the Hungarian coat of arms. If it was, that meant that she had located a small portion of the Hungarian national treasury that had gone missing during World War II at the hands of the Nazis. It was a stunning find, and one the world would probably never know about, for it was going directly into the hands of a criminal.
No matter. Doug is the important thing. Save him and worry about the gold later.
She slipped the gold brick into the bag on her dive belt and was in the process of trying to maneuver herself around to head back the way she had come when the watch on her wrist vibrated. 10 minutes of air remained. It was time to head back to the surface. Turning, she began to pull herself back down the access tunnel in the direction that she'd come, It would take a minute or two to exit the aircraft, and then a few more to follow the guide wire to the surface. She'd make it without difficulty. Or so she thought. The last thing she expected was to reach the end of the access tunnel and find another diver poking about in the front section of the cockpit. His dive light was secured to the front portion of the canopy and pointing into the cockpit, illuminating the area well enough for her to see by. At first, she thought that Paul or Garin had disobeyed her instructions and had come down with her despite their lack of cold water diving experience. But then she noticed that the other diver was dressed in a different model of dry suit than the one she wore. All of the gear Garin had purchased had been of the same make and design. That meant there was a stranger down there with her. Anya immediately doused her dive light, not wanting to give away her position to the newcomer. She also recognized right away that she couldn't remain where she was. Getting caught in the access tunnel while her air ran out was not something she intended to experience. The skeletal remains of the pilot and gunner were gone, apparently tossed out of the cockpit by the newcomer. Anya could see him crouched inside the front section of the cockpit, most likely on the pilot's seat, but she couldn't see what he was doing. Knowing that every second she waited was another second of air she wasted, Anya didn't hesitate. She reached up, grabbed both sides of the opening to the access tunnel, and propelled herself forward with a downward thrust of her arms so that she came floating out of the opening in one smooth motion. Her sudden appearance, rising up out of the back of the cockpit like a ghost, had to have shocked the other diver.